in Rockford. The Wednesday forecast from the National Weather Service, sunny and hot for the morning, cloudy and rainy for the afternoon. Today's high 91, heat index around 96. The numbers now, humidity 74%, 80 degrees in Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today we talk about public education and its place in our American democracy, the crucial role that it plays, and the ways in which it is not serving the entire populace of our country as much as we might hope and dream, expect, maybe assume. A really interesting new book has just been written called The Open System, Redesigning Education and Reigniting Democracy. It is the contention of the co-authors of this book, including my morning show guest today, Dani Tran, that public education is one of the key cornerstones of democracy. And that when a democracy is ailing, struggling, often some of the causes of that can be traced to our public education system and the kind of education that is being delivered. And on the other hand, public education can be a driver in terms of the health and well-being of a democracy or the rebuilding of a democracy. That and much more is explored in this really interesting book. My guest today on the morning show, Dani Tran, is a partner at the Center for Innovation in Education, a former assistant superintendent for the Boston Public Schools. He has also worked with school systems in California and in Georgia, and has actually worked with any number of school districts all across the country. And his expertise, along with that of his co-author, have been brought to bear in study of this system and, in particular, the importance of our public education operating in a way that is far more open than is often the case. This book, The Open System, Redesigning Education and Reigniting Democracy, is published by Harvard Education Press. And Dani Tran, we welcome you to the morning show.
Oh, it's such a pleasure to be here, Greg. Thank you for having me.
I'm excited to have this opportunity to speak with you. Could we get a little more information about you in terms of your life in the world of education? And did your career in education begin with you as a teacher, or have you been kind of in other areas of education from the start?
No, I love this question so much. I really appreciate you digging into my story a little bit. So I began my career as a middle school and high school science teacher in California, in Oakland, California, and Boston, Massachusetts. And I've loved the classroom. It was such a joyful time of my life working with students directly. But I left the classroom to help launch Teach for America Massachusetts. I was a Teach for America alum in California. And then went to graduate school, which is where I met my co-author, Landon Mascareñas, at Harvard Ed School. And then after that, began working in the central office in Boston Public Schools, where I led the academics and professional learning department. And then went to work for Fulton County Schools, leading the Innovative Programs division there, before joining the Center for Innovation in Education, where we focus more on the policy side of the conversation, but still very much from the frame of how do we include more of the broader community and stakeholders in the creation of that kind of policy.
Early in the book, you say, you and your co-author, we are at an urgent crossroads when it comes to the world of public education. Tell us some more about this urgent crossroads and what leads you to use that language in describing the current moment.
Well, it's our belief that for far too long in education and in many public sector organizations, we have just simply not been as responsive to the communities that we claim to serve. And this is particularly true in education, that for quite a while, most of the solutions in education have been imposed on schools and communities from the outside, rather than actively involving them in the co-creation and co-production of the sorts of solutions that would be both valuable and viable within their community context. And that's really eroded trust from the community in the institutions that are really meant to be the cradle of our civic life and our democracy. And so we have a moment now where I think people are asking and really, you know, really trying to cultivate deeper community involvement, and yet don't really have a language or a really robust discipline about how to do that. And at the same time, on the other side, we have this influx of community and parent energy from every sector of our country and our community, really trying to push into school systems. And we're just not really well equipped to engage with that energy. And so we think that this book is coming at a time when we are trying to navigate those two tensions, like wanting community voice and yet not quite knowing what to do with all of this community energy that's really knocking at the door.
Right. And that in some cases feels and looks very positive, and in some other settings, and we'll probably get to this, sometimes that sense of communities or members of the community pushing for more hands-on involvement in public education can sometimes be a little scary. It sometimes can be even a little ugly. And I think what you're touching on and what you were just saying is kind of the complexity of this, and that I don't think you want any of us thinking about this in entirely idyllic terms.
That's right. I mean, we say to the folks that we engage with, and we're very lucky to have done work at the school level with principals and school leaders, at the district level with superintendents and their senior staff, and at state education agency levels as well, with commissioners of education across the country, that being an open leader is difficult work, and it is incredibly powerful and enriching and soul satisfying, but it is not for the faint of heart, because you have to have a real willingness to be vulnerable and a real willingness to lead in a different way. Hmm. And one of the things that we encourage is a mental shift from thinking about community engagement as a sort of third rail, you know, as a mental model, like if you touch it, then something terrible is going to happen, to really thinking about it as a live wire, which contains energy, but that just needs to be channeled, that can, if done correctly, can really power a lot of really incredible innovations and adaptations and initiatives within your system.
Following up on the question about this urgent crossroads at which we find ourselves and kind of the timing of your book, I want to be sure to take a moment to ask you about something that you mention in the book's introduction, namely the COVID-19 pandemic, which, of course, descended in such a big way in much of the country in the spring of 2020. And from what you describe, that ended up being a crisis that had a whole lot of, in a sense, unanticipated or unintended consequences some of them negative, some of them positive. And one arena of public life, of course, that was drastically, dramatically impacted was public education, and education at all systems, including at the collegiate level, of course. And out of that sprang some examples of what I think you are advocating, namely this idea of closed systems becoming more open. Describe to our listeners the ways in which the COVID-19 pandemic, in a sense, hastened this process, or maybe kind of raised this possibility in places that it would otherwise not have been proposed or embraced.
Yeah. One idea that I just want to sort of build understanding around first is that closed systems try to limit the possibilities that occur across the boundary between inside and outside. So they try to become very predictable and reliable, and in that case, they actually limit the kinds of engagements that people can have with them. So schools that are very closed set limits and boundaries, very tight ones, on the ways that families and communities can engage with them. And what that often means is that they become unable to handle high variety situations. So things with a lot of variables, things with a lot of unknowns, because they can only really process inputs based on the very limited parameters about how they operate. And so if you can imagine then putting a very closed system in the middle of a very, very, I'm sure you can take this out in post, but putting a very closed system into a very uncertain situation like COVID, it's trying to design policies and procedures for a situation that's changing on a daily or weekly basis. And that is a very tough situation to put that school in, as opposed to an open system where you have you actually are in a habit of co-creating with your community, co-creating and allowing lots of inputs and information to kind of flow into the system, and having many processes for making sense of all of that. And so when an open system, our contention is that in a highly variable situation, an open system is just able to unlock so much more capacity, is able to do more with the community and engage them and include them in the process of redesigning itself to meet the current moment. And what we saw in a lot of communities that had this sort of openness built into them is that they were able to respond, you know, to changing situations and empower people locally, school leaders locally, to make decisions based on new information, and then to process that and make changes across the system to be more responsive. And what we saw is that that really built up, rather than actually having people be sort of dismayed by that variability, actually built a lot of trust, because the community could understand and see that the system was trying to be responsive. It was being transparent with information and making its sort of logic clear and involving the community in that decision-making process. And so I think that's what we saw in the kind of communities that handled COVID most effectively.
Interesting. It's a very intriguing way to look at that moment, because I think some of our intuition might suggest the opposite being true, that in a situation that is complicated and challenging and very unpredictable, and who knows what next little facet of this crisis is going to be around the next corner, in many respects our most visceral response to that is the hope for really strong, centralized leadership speaking with a singular voice, in a sense, telling us what to do. And there's just something sort of clean and simple about that picture. And it can be a very tempting image in a moment of crisis like that. And what you're suggesting is that we maybe need to discard that notion that that is the best kind of leadership in a moment like that.
That's, I think that's a really well said, Greg, that people do crave certainty, and they do, they crave the feeling that somebody knows what's happening. and that in very, very complex situations, we do need to encourage the capacity of the public to handle more nuance and complexity, which I think we would agree with back to this kind of conversation about democracy. You know, we do, I think, are at this inflection moment where we have to build our appetite and capacity for complexity. And that is something that we have to practice and in our daily life. And that's one of the reasons why we focus so much on education, is most people's first engagement with public systems and democracy are through their schools, both the young people in the schools and the parents that engage with the school system. And we have to ask ourselves, what kind of activities are we apprenticing people into? What kind of mindsets are we apprenticing people into? And we have these wonderful examples throughout the book of leaders who have been able to build that kind of capacity. I'm thinking particularly of one school leader in Denver who said, you know, the school is, his name's Drew Schutz, at Valverde Elementary. And he said, you know, this is not my school and this is not my vision. My job is to understand what the community needs and wants and then help to execute that. And so he's brought so many families into his school to help co-construct what the vision of their school is going to be. And that has actually unlocked tons of capacity, as now families understand deeply what that vision is, and they're finding ways to help bring it about and bringing that into the system in really powerful ways. Hmm.
Before we dig into kind of the heart and soul of the book, there are a couple other points in the introduction that I want to touch on and get some clarification from you. At one point, you and your co-author say, this book is committed to rejecting previous tropes and stigmas of community-driven work. At least in a nutshell, can you summarize what some of those previous tropes and stigmas are that that maybe you regard as counterproductive or distractions or in some other way require rejection in order to really take on the possibilities that you are putting forth in your book?
Sure. I think we can name some of the habits of community engagement that tend to be used. And I don't want to impugn anybody for doing these things, because I think they're doing them from a good place, using surveys, using focus groups, but stopping there as if there is this one-way flow of information, like give us what you know, and then we as the experts are going to take that into a room and make a plan. And then we'll, if you're lucky, we'll share it back to you. but that is not a trust expanding or trust building behavior. And what I sometimes joke with people is that you never see anybody on Twitter or Facebook defending a policy from a school district that they filled out a survey for. A survey and a focus group does not engender the kind of deep ownership of a strategy or an initiative that we think is characteristic of a truly open system. And so in an open system, we think of deep co-creation being one of the hallmarks of that, that we invite people not only to share their experience, but to work shoulder to shoulder with us to create the solutions and then to help enact them. And that, when we do that, you see this much deeper commitment and much deeper buy-in to what's created, where you then do see people, you know, sharing with other parents, like, this is what we made, and this is why we made it. And they have a deeper understanding of the rationale behind certain decisions and can be your partners in communicating that outwards to the community.
In that very same paragraph that I just now quoted, you and your co-author make reference to synthesizing old and new wisdom. And I thought that was a really interesting turn of phrase. And among other things, it kind of maybe is a bit of a reminder that you two are not the first to sort of sound the alarm and talk about the need for renovation or reformation or transformation of our education system, and concerns of various kinds have been raised over the decades. And for that matter, when we look at the history of public education, there have been certainly some interesting chapters in terms of certain things that have come and gone and different models that have come to the forefront. So it's not just a complicated present, but it's a complicated past as well. And I'm really intrigued by that notion of you and your co-author wanting to synthesize old and new wisdom. What does that look like from your perspective? Or how are you trying to do that, and how do you want the rest of us to do that?
Sure. There's such a deep reservoir and body of knowledge around how to build and operate school systems. And there's an incredible body of research around community engagement and involvement. And there's a really wonderful and deep, rich vein of scholarship around leadership. And what we try to do is weave it all together into a schema around open and closed, rather than having these things be sort of distinct from each other. So we start by thinking through, well, what are the personal orientations required to lead in this way? And then looking inwards first, and then looking outwards to ask ourselves, okay, then how do we need to conceptualize and think about our communities? And how do we increase the complexity of our understanding of that? And then once we understand our community context, how do we construct a powerful teams and spaces where really deep co-creation work can occur? So we should make that shift from both, like, from leadership into sort of organizational design, and then the facilitation of those sorts of spaces, and then the expansion of those habits of working throughout our organizations. And so we're sort of weaving together this idea of leadership, organizational design, facilitation, and then partnerships and expansion of that kind of work. And so we're hoping that the disciplines that have informed each of those threads can become a cohesive whole within the context of creating an open system that's grounded in an idea of open leadership and sort of openness on an individual level as well.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Donnie Tran. He is the co-author, along with Landon Mascareñas, of a new book called The Open System, Redesigning Education and Reigniting Democracy. In this book, the possibility is raised of public education becoming a much more open versus closed system. And there are a number of ways in which this is explored in this book. And much of the book is drawn upon personal working experience that Donnie Tran and Landon Mascareñas has in the various school districts that they have worked with across the country. As I was reading your book and thinking about open systems versus closed systems, a couple of overarching questions come to mind. And of course, it's really important for us to make sure that our listeners have a very clear understanding of the difference between the two. One thing that came to mind is, you know, if I was about to move to Boise, Idaho, and I Google Boise public school system, you know, to find out more about the public schools there, it's not like the website is going to say Boise, Idaho public school system is a closed system and it's blah, 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 you know, all this other stuff. I mean, that is not something that anybody, I don't think, is going to trumpet as a characteristic of the school district that, you know, of which they're proud or, you know, what it's important information to disseminate. It's a reality that perhaps even the school system itself is not really aware of. Can you talk a little bit more about kind of the difference between open systems and closed systems and to what extent being a closed system is ever a conscious choice made by a school district? Or is it more, is it almost always something that is kind of passed down through the generations without very much awareness whatsoever that it exists?
That's what a beautiful question. We do think that it is a mix of conscious and unconscious choices, that there are mental models that people hold about the way that public systems like education should operate that favor certain types of expertise. So you've got, like, we know what we're doing, and we'll let you know when we need your help. That model can often result in sort of closed behaviors that limit the kind of interaction of between a system and its community and the kind of information that can flow back and forth. And so we always see, though, that there are folks who are eager within any system to be more open, to be more co-creative. And just to define that a little bit more, we think that open systems are designed explicitly and intentionally to co-create with their communities. And that's what really characterizes, I think, some, and be responsive to their communities. And so we know, though, that that can't happen everywhere all the time with every system. And so or at least not yet, because I think that the systems are just not, that we are dealing with legacy systems of how to function and how to work. But within every system, there are people and departments and projects that invite greater openness and where people can begin to operate in that way and really pioneer things. And so that's why we get into how to take advantage of those moments and those opportunities, and then how to look at ways of expanding that way of working into new areas, new projects, is as a leadership activity.
I'm so glad you answered the question as you did, because it anticipated my second question, which was going to be about that whole notion of a school system being one or the other. And I think what you are pointing to is what is typically a more complicated situation. I mean, I have a feeling there are in our country plenty of school districts that are decisively and in almost every respect closed, and probably other school systems that are quite open. And maybe the most common of all are some that are a mix of the two in some respect. Is that fair to say?
I think that's fair, Greg, that there is always a sort of spectrum of openness and closed behaviors that are exhibited by every system and every leader, frankly. You know, I can think back to my own experience as an assistant superintendent. There were things that I did that would certainly be more closed, and there were certain things that I did that would be characterized as more open. And that, I think that's part of the discipline and language that we're trying to introduce into the system, so that people can reflect on that and also find other people who are curious and interested in doing things in a similar way.
I want to ask you about something that I really appreciated being in your book. And let me preface this by saying that whenever I read any kind of a book like this, I find one way in which I am often skeptical is when sometimes a picture is being painted that ignores some of the messier details. And I really applaud you and your co-author for not doing that. That is, as you talk about creating more open systems in the world of public education, you do not do it with any illusions that that process will be simple or without complications. And I really appreciate the realism with which you are framing this whole conversation. At one point, I think this is still in the introduction to the book, you write, movements to increase public participation in decision-making face significant headwinds that can undermine trust. Powerful interests can co-opt structures that are designed to increase the voice of citizens, a process that researchers call regulatory capture or elite capture. Powerful groups and individuals can seize processes that were originally meant to amplify the voices and concerns of marginalized groups and interrupt projects that would benefit many. I really appreciate that because I think all of us can think of experiences in our lives if we serve on the board of directors of the local symphony or community theater, or we're part of the parents group for Little League or whatever. We can think about certain strident voices that in a sense kind of take over the proceedings and maybe hijack what is meant to be something in which all of us are heard. And all of us are valued participants. And I really appreciate the fact that you and your co-author, in a sense, own up to this reality, to that this part of it. I would really appreciate you talking for a moment about that and the way in which you think an open system can be designed in which this kind of potential, let's call it a threat, can maybe be minimized or at least managed.
Yes, we acknowledge the reality and the history of elite capture or regulatory capture, as we describe it, and as literature describes it. And we not only acknowledge it, we really take it on. And that's something that I think was at the heart of our writing of this. We take it on in a couple of really important ways, we think. And this has been a trial and error process. We have learned by doing this very often in a number of different contexts. So we address it by first thinking about the space we create and who is included in that space. It is known, you know, the literature on regulatory capture shows that people who tend to participate in things like zoning decisions or, neighborhood associations tend to be older, wealthier, and whiter than the populace as a whole. And so we think about this breakthrough space idea through the lens of how do we bring an unusual and really more deeply inclusive group to the table with these sorts of processes. And so we actually have this three-part method that we've used successfully in a number of contexts where we acknowledge that there are some people who are politically important and there are some people who are just interested and want to be a part of it. And then there's a whole subset of the population that may never have heard of this process or even have heard of this initiative, but live the experience of dealing with it every day. And so with those three groups in mind, we actually have a three-part process for bringing together a coalition or a working group. The first is acknowledging that essential stakeholder group of politically important people we say, all right, a third of this working group is going to be directly appointed by the leadership. In one case, the commissioner of education in Kentucky said, yep, we've got to have these important people, so I'm going to allocate, you know, a third of the seats to these people. A third of the, another third is dedicated to an open application process.
This is a monthly test of the Southeast and South Central Wisconsin Emergency Alert System. In the event of an emergency, this system would bring you important information. This test is now concluded.
It really can short circuit a lot of the regulatory capture pitfalls because you've included explicitly many, many more voices that are representative of different perspectives within the system. But that wouldn't work on its own unless you facilitated that group really effectively. And how do you facilitate a more creative democratic process that doesn't look like your standard task force? And so we have a number of strategies, a lot of them rooted in the design thinking tradition around how do you empathize with people's experience and how do you come to a common consensus around the problem that you're facing, and then use creative strategies to try to think of solutions.
Right. I appreciate the fact that your book goes up beyond just kind of the principles and concept, the philosophy, to talk about very concrete specifics. And at one point you write, a key term in the research is implemented well, a challenge and charge that led us to generate the principles and practices detailed in this book. In our experience, much of the discourse around community participation is that it must be sloppy, unclear, and fraught with danger. And you go on to say in the next sentence, we reject this stereotype. And I have a feeling that those words are going to really resonate with a lot of people who might regard this as, in a sense, somewhat dangerous.
Yeah, we think that deliberative democracy and really clear decision making doesn't happen by accident. It happens through really careful planning and really thoughtful facilitation. And, you know, both Landon and myself were former teachers, and so sometimes we think about it as like, how do you create a really great learning experience for people? And how do you create a really powerful, co-creative, deliberative process by which you can co-create something? And really great teachers do this all the time. They in their classrooms, create a really thoughtful, deliberative space where people are doing authentic work, and young people are doing authentic work. And so we brought a lot of those lessons into our practice of deliberative public leadership. How do you create opportunities for real learning from each other? You know, members of the group having different expertise, different lived experience, but they can learn from each other. And creating a space where that can happen is one of the key open leadership moves. And then making very clear decision-making processes and really thoughtful co-creation processes work in tandem to make sure that it's the right kind of messy. You know, there's we're not saying that everything's going to be clean all the time, but the messiness needs to be for the purpose of getting to something rich, powerful, and co-created. And so we have a number of strategies by which we do that.
Right. I was struck at one point when you say many leaders, and I think you're speaking primarily about leaders in education, but probably leaders in other spheres of public life as well, many leaders simply lack the language and structure to enact their ambitious community plans. And part of what your book is all about is equipping them to move forward with the right structures and with the right language in order to implement this well, as we were talking about before. Your book is crafted around six key moves in which a system can be moved from closed to open. It probably would be helpful for you to talk our listeners through what those six moves are.
Sure. And we're just enjoying this conversation so much, Greg, and you've helped us sort of span much of the concepts, or many of the concepts in the book. So I just appreciate your thoughtful facilitation of this time together. And so some of these things will be resonant to some of the things that we've talked about already. But the first is activating your own open leadership. So that's that internal reflection element, like, who are you? What do you bring to this? What are your orientations to openness? The next key principle is knowing your community and understanding and expanding your ideas about what community is and who is in it, and acknowledging that there are going to be moments and opportunities for openness within your community context, and how do you identify those? Then the next discipline or next process is designing breakthrough spaces. So that's that idea of how do you create these sort of unusually representative or usually inclusive groups to do the work together. And then the next is modeling creative democracy. So in those spaces, how do you deliberate thoughtfully and come to unique and powerful solutions that have a consensus behind them? Then the next principle is assembling abundance partnerships. So in order to actually do this work, it's very difficult for the system to do it alone, to co-produce the value, the public value that we claim. And so you have to really think about partnerships through the lens of abundance in order to be able to execute. And then the next principle is expanding openness. So once you've done it within one context, created this really co-creative, powerful space, what are the other opportunities for, you know, enacting an open system within your organizational context? How do you take it from one project to another, or to another department, to another process? And so that's the arc, you know, sort of a beginning to end overview of the principles that we think can accelerate open system design.
And do you, as you lay these out, do you intend them to be done successively? I mean, you do the first thing, then the second thing, then the third thing, or is it a little more complicated arc than that?
It's recursive, you know, sometimes, and sometimes it's linear. What we offer these up as is not necessarily like a recipe or linear set of things, but acknowledging that some things do kind of flow in a progression, that it's hard to get to a open project and co-creation space without having thought about the inclusion of multiple voices. So we do think that there's a little bit of linearity to it, but also acknowledge that in complex situations and systems, you sometimes have to go back and do things over again and revisit initial assumptions. And so acknowledge that there is often a non-linearity to all of this.
You say at one point in the book, it cannot be an all-at-once endeavor. Why not?
We think that most political contexts and most contexts of educational systems are so locked into a certain set of habits and ways of working that are closed in nature, that to try to enact these open principles across every part of your system all at once would overtax the capacity of most of the people in the system, because it is work to do work, to do education systems in this way. And so what we really advocate is for people to do it in a way that's visible and can be seen and observed by other parts of the system, and then to have people adopt these ways of working in a more manageable way, because I think that's just generally more respectful of people's the way that people learn and grow. What we know about human learning and development is that you learn from other people, you learn by observing and being in dialogue with people who are doing things differently. And so we just take that approach in thinking about how to expand openness within a system.
Right. I think some people might, depending on where they live and kind of the general nature of the community in which they live, might fear that, you know, a given school system might, in a sense, fall prey to the biases or the ignorance or whatever of the general population, and they hold up the education system as something that it's meant to elevate and hold fast to certain principles, and that if there is too much in the way of involvement / interference, that sometimes those very important principles can come under attack. And certainly, you know, one can think about certain examples, maybe even our own history, in which certain steps forward in terms of things like inclusiveness or making education more equitable, for instance, across racial lines, would never have happened if the ultimate shaping of that education system had been left up to the citizens of that particular community. Is that something we have to think about as we move towards this possibility?
I think it's a great example of the tension that this work sort of sits inside, is that, yes, there are sometimes roles for, you know, the state and federal governments who have an eye towards certain societal objectives to say, you know what, this is the rule. we have to safeguard our collective interest by imposing this. And we acknowledge that this is something that is a part of how we make progress. When we think about then sometimes the backlash that sort of very strong move can engender, then we have to ask ourselves, okay, is there a way to do it that does build a broader consensus and a broader commitment to a public good? And we do think that there's space within many of these processes for doing that. So if there is something that is contentious, that is seen to be, this is in our public interest and we need to do it, then the ways in which it's enacted locally can be done in a way that is more open, so that people can learn from each other and hash out some of the details and particulars about how it's going to be implemented. And in that way, maybe lower some of the resistance that you would otherwise see if it was imposed entirely from the outside. Mm-hmm. And so there is this back and forth between, all right, we got to set these bold standards and bold positions. How do we enact it in a way that's that our community can build deeper consensus around?
Hmm. You write at one point, education is our greatest democracy building endeavor. And at a time when many of us are thinking about the health of our own democracy, this conversation, this possibility becomes even more important. And your book gave me so much to think about. Again, it's titled The Open System, Redesigning Education and Reigniting Democracy, published by Harvard Education Press, co-authored by Landon Mascareñas and my morning show guest, Donnie Tran. Donnie Tran, thank you so much for, first of all, giving the world this really important book. And thank you for joining me today on the morning show. I was really honored to speak with you. Thank you for your great work.
Oh, I really appreciate your thoughtful questions. And it was really fun. Thank you.
Tomorrow on the morning show, Linda Guy will join us to talk about this year's Secret Garden Walk, sponsored by the Four Seasons Garden Club. And on Friday, we remember the great actor Alan Arkin, who passed